From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Nice to be here. One of my favorite authors is Richard Booty. Of course, you remember him from The Charmer. And he has a new book out now called, and I'm going to screw this first part up, Centauni. I'm Canadian. I can't speak Italian. The Sinatra Legend at 100. Richard, how are you?
Nice to be with you, Dana. Thank you.
How bad did I screw that up? Centauni?
A little bit. Actually, it's an Italian toast, and it means 100 years.
Okay.
It's pronounced Centauni with a soft C.
Centauni. How's that?
Exactly.
Is that better?
That's perfect.
How have you been? You're a busy guy.
I've been fine, thanks. Working hard on this Sinatra book to get it out in time for Sinatra's centennial, which occurs on December 12th, and our book is coming out on November 10th.
And how hard is that to believe? You know, it's been 100 years. Everybody loves Sinatra. Lots to talk about, you know, as far as the book goes, but 100 years, you know, it's definitely a change. All the old-timers are gone, I guess.
Yeah, it was very hard getting interviews, of course, with people who knew him personally because they're all gone.
Yeah, no, for sure. What made you choose Sinatra?
Well, the centennial year was really the hook that got me interested. I had been a fan of his all my life growing up, and I just love his music. I knew a lot about him as an individual, too, because I read everything that came out about him because I was that big a fan. But I decided I wanted to do a book. You know, this is my sixth book, so I was looking around for a subject last November and December, and I decided this would be the perfect subject in this upcoming year.
You know, when we talk Frank Sinatra, everyone thinks of the Rat Pack and, you know, the movies and Ava Gardner and all that. We'll get into that a little bit. But what fact about Frank Sinatra were you surprised to find out that most of us will be shocked to hear in your book?
Well, you know, I talk about Sinatra in many instances in a loving way as a fan. But I don't pull any punches, and I also talk about certain aspects of his character, of his behavior that were reprehensible. And perhaps the most reprehensible aspect of his behavior was my finding out for the first time by doing my research that Sinatra, when he was 33 years old, and when he had just won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor in From Here to Eternity, this was in May of 1954, the Oscar had been awarded to him in March of 54. But in May of 1954, he started up a sexual relationship with a 15-year-old Hollywood child star by the name of Natalie Wood. We all remember Natalie from her portrayal in Miracle on 34th Street when I think she was maybe 9 or 10 years old, but when she was 15, Sinatra actually started a sexual relationship with her that lasted for most of her life, but it began when she was a minor, and it began in a way that made Sinatra, I think, guilty of statutory rape.
The book, my author, Richard Moody, is available, and you can click on the link in the show notes to purchase it. You know, and again, Natalie Wood, Ava Gardner, and we could go on and on and on with the girlfriends, but it was interesting to see and to read about Sinatra and his, we've all seen the connections with the Kennedys, but what about his connection with Nixon and maybe a special favor that he had Nixon do for him?
This was also a new thing that I learned during my research, and I don't think it was covered very extensively in any previous Sinatra biography. Sinatra, when he was coming up, became very friendly with a New Jersey mafia type by the name of Angelo Gyp DiCarlo. Gyp was his nickname. He didn't like it much, but that's what some people called him. DiCarlo, Angelo Gyp DiCarlo, was also from Hoboken. As a matter of fact, he had been friendly with Frank's mother, Dolly Sinatra. Dolly had actually babysat for Gyp DiCarlo when he was just a baby. Anyway, DiCarlo had, as many of the mafia leaders in those days in New York and New Jersey, DiCarlo had ins with certain nightclubs in New Jersey, notably the Rustic Cabin in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, and also the Riviera in Fort Lee, New Jersey. And DiCarlo was instrumental in getting Sinatra into some of those venues early in Sinatra's career when he was struggling as a singer, actually, and not really the name that he would later become. Anyway, fast forward to the early 1970s, late 60s, DiCarlo gets indicted by a very top-notch New Jersey prosecutor, the U.S. attorney Frederick B. Lacey, gets indicted. Gyp DiCarlo gets indicted for extortion and is convicted in 1970 and sentenced for 12 years. This was a relatively minor charge that they got him on. He had been suspected in many, many killings and tortures and other racketeering activities. Anyway, he was convicted in 70 and sentenced to 12 years. Sinatra, working through Vice President Spiro Agnew, who was a close buddy to Sinatra, Sinatra was able, according to my looking at the evidence and my opinion, Sinatra was able to get President Richard Nixon to commute DiCarlo's sentence. Jeez. In December of 1972, and DiCarlo gets let out of prison after serving less than 3 years and goes home. Now, DiCarlo was ill with cancer, and the reason given for the commutation was that the prison warden didn't want DiCarlo dying in prison from cancer. But, I mean, those sorts of things happened all of the time. I mean, in my mind, it was a bogus reason. And I felt quite strongly. I interviewed two of the U.S. attorneys who were involved in the DiCarlo case, and I pored over FBI files, and it's my contention, and I lay out the case very strongly in my book, that actually Sinatra was the reason he got out by working through Spiro Agnew.
It's interesting that you, as a former prosecutor, looking at this case, would have that angle to, again, review the evidence. What about Richard Moody, the prosecutor, and seeing something like this? How did you feel?
Well, I felt bad about it because this guy shouldn't have been let out, and it was, you know, influence being used at the highest levels, which I don't like in any instance. You know, I'm not only a former prosecutor, I'm a former mayor of my hometown, and I've been involved in politics, and I just despise the way politics are conducted in many parts of this country. But in any event, that prosecutorial skill that I developed after spending 19 years as a prosecutor in collecting evidence and examining it and taking a logical look at it and then laying out a case, much as I would have done for a jury to persuade a jury, that's the skill that I bring to every aspect of this book, because not only was Sinatra involved in this Gyp DiCarlo commutation of sentence, but there are many other aspects of Sinatra's life that have been subject to different interpretations. But I brought my skill as a prosecutor to bear on the subject and really, I think, come up with a unique book that no other publication has ever taken that approach to his life.
You mentioned politics, and I would be remiss not to ask you your thoughts on what's been going on here lately, especially with the Republican candidates and politics in general, with the election coming just around the corner. What do you think?
Well, I'm a politics junkie, and I read two newspapers every day and a bunch of news magazines, and I watch all of the talk shows on television, much to my wife's dismay. But I've been following the race very closely. Trump is a little upset right now because Ben Carson has overtaken him in Iowa in the polls. But in any event, I think Trump has a very very nice path to the Republican nomination. It'll be interesting to see in future debates whether he is challenged to give any specifics about his policies, his policy proposals. I'm a little bit more of a substance person than I am, a theatrical person. I wish candidates would spend more time on the substance of the problems that we face rather than glossing over them with one or two sentence sound bites. I really don't like that brand of politics.
You know, all the politicians are comparing themselves, or they're bringing up Reagan quotes and comments and comparisons. In fact, one of the debates was held at the Reagan Library. Sinatra had a relationship with Reagan, did he not?
He did. Actually, Reagan was instrumental in getting Sinatra the Congressional Medal of Freedom, which was awarded to Frank, I think, in 1985. I cover that in the book. They became friends after Reagan won the governorship in California. Actually, Sinatra had supported Pat Brown, the Democrat, the first time that Reagan won the governorship in California over Sinatra's pick of Pat Brown. Then Sinatra had a falling out with the Democrats in California, and he actually initially didn't like Reagan very much, but he saw Reagan as a future star, and like most people, we like to hitch our wagons to a star, and so he jumped on Reagan's bandwagon when Reagan ran for re-election in California, and then also supported him for the presidency.
Of course, the Kennedys are part of the Sinatra mystique, and in fact, going right back to the election of Jack and the apparent Sinatra influence of the mob to get him those votes. What about that? What about Sinatra, the Democrat, going to Sinatra, the Republican?
Well, Sinatra was raised as a Democrat, and his mother, Dolly, probably more than any other person in Sinatra's entire life, had the most influence over him. She was a dominant personality herself, and she was a Democratic ward healer in Hoboken, New Jersey, and really rose to prominence in that corner of the state, Hoboken, Hudson County, New Jersey, which was a corrupt area of New Jersey as far as politics were concerned. Hudson County was controlled by a guy named Frank I Am the Boss Haig. Most people who take an interest in political history would recognize that name. But in any event, Dolly was a force because she had organized the Italian immigrants and then the Italian vote in Hoboken. And soon she was able, through her local organizing, to deliver reliably 600 votes to the Democratic machine in every election. Frank was, growing up, was exposed to that influence of politics on the Democratic side, and he kept that Democratic bent. He met Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1944 when Roosevelt was running for president, was actually invited to the White House and was thrilled by FDR in the White House. And he supported Democratic candidates right up through Hubert Humphrey, the first time that Hubert Humphrey ran, and then after he became friendly with Spiro Agnew, switched over to the Republicans for Nixon's reelection campaign in 72. But in any event, in the 1960 election, which you reference, Sinatra got strongly behind Jack Kennedy. And Sinatra was thrilled to be included in Kennedy's inner circle. One of Sinatra's Rat Pack buddies, Peter Lawford, had married a Kennedy sister, Pat Lawford Kennedy, and Sinatra was friendly with them. Kennedy would make many trips to the West Coast and stay with the Lawfords, and Sinatra was invited over, and You know, there was a lot of camaraderie between them, and Sinatra was soon invited to sit in on strategic talks about the 1960 election. This was when it was Senator Jack Kennedy. In any event, Kennedy's father, Ambassador Joe Kennedy, approached Sinatra and asked Sinatra if he would give Jack help in the West Virginia primary election. In those days, there weren't the same political processes in place as there are now. Not all of the states had primaries, but those that did were extremely important in influencing party bigwigs to back a particular candidate. If a candidate did well in the few primaries, that was a reason for other Democratic bosses to get behind that candidate, and Joe Kennedy wanted his son to do well in West Virginia, which was going to be a problem. He was up against Hubert Humphrey in that West Virginia 1960 primary in the spring of 1960, and Kennedy had another problem. He was a Catholic, and Catholics were a very small minority of the West Virginia electorate. And as a matter of fact, the large Protestant majority in West Virginia was notably anti-Catholic. And so Joe Kennedy approached Sinatra and asked Sinatra to intercede with a Chicago mobster by the name of Sam Giancana. Giancana had his fingers into all of the unions, organized unions around the country. And unionism was quite strong in West Virginia, especially with the coal miners. And so Joe Kennedy said to Frank, can you get Sam to intervene in West Virginia and get the unions behind Jack Kennedy? And that's exactly what Sinatra did. He got Giancana to go ahead and do this on behalf of Jack Kennedy in West Virginia. Giancana spread around $50,000 in cash to various people in West Virginia to get out the vote on behalf of Kennedy. And lo and behold, Kennedy won the West Virginia primary, and that was the primary election that really propelled Kennedy into the Democratic nomination that summer at the convention.
And what, of course, we've all seen the movies and the documentaries, but what ended the Sinatra, I'm not sure if ended is the right term, but what was the final straw between the Kennedys and the Sinatra? Was it Bobby Kennedy that stopped that relationship?
Yes, it was Bobby Kennedy. Jack, after he was elected, continued the friendship with Frank Sinatra, and Jack was planning in March of 1962, planning a trip to the West Coast. And arrangements were made through Peter Lawford for Jack Kennedy to stay at Sinatra's Palm Springs compound in California during his sojourn in California. And Sinatra went all out to really prepare his very palatial compound for Kennedy's arrival. He had a helicopter pad installed. He had a flagpole installed for the presidential flag when Kennedy was going to be visiting. He actually built a separate cottage in the compound for Kennedy and his entourage, and another place for the Secret Service men who would accompany him. He probably spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to get his property ready for the presidential visit. But then FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover provided information to Bobby Kennedy, who was technically Hoover's boss as Attorney General of the United States, about Sinatra's mob connections. The Kennedy family already knew all about Sinatra's mob connections because they had used those connections to win the presidency. Bobby Kennedy had been Jack's campaign manager and certainly knew about his father's proselytizing to get Sam Giancana involved in West Virginia. So anyway, once J. Edgar Hoover knew about those mob connections, and Bobby Kennedy knew that Hoover knew, Bobby went to Jack Kennedy and said, Jack, you can't stay with Sinatra. You've got to separate yourself from him. It's just going to be too bad for you publicity-wise. And Bobby Kennedy persuaded Jack not to stay with Sinatra when he visited the West Coast, and to add salt to that wound to Sinatra's pride. It was probably the most humiliating thing that ever happened to Sinatra. To add salt to that wound, Kennedy ended up staying with Bing Crosby, a Republican, and that made the disaster complete as far as Frank was concerned. He only spoke to Bobby Kennedy one other time after that, and that was when his son was kidnapped. Frank Jr. was kidnapped in December of 63, shortly after Jack Kennedy was assassinated, and when young Frank Sinatra was kidnapped, Frank swallowed his pride and actually spoke with Bobby Kennedy to try to get the federal government and FBI involved in the hunt for Frank Sinatra Jr.'s safe return, and actually they were very instrumental in getting him back safely.
The book, Satani, the Sinatra Legend at 100, my author Richard Muti is here. And you mentioned we've talked a lot that Sinatra from Hoboken, and I believe his dad was a fireman there, and he may not have got along well with his dad, and Sinatra himself called Hoboken a sewer, but then again, it was kind of a love-hate relationship with his hometown. Let's talk about his relationship with his family a little bit and his hometown.
Sure. Sinatra did have that love-hate relationship, not only with Hoboken, but with the entire state of New Jersey. He had altercations with the Casino Control Commission in the 1980s, and he looked upon himself as really a New Yorker more than a Hoboken native or a New Jersey guy. When he was with Tommy Dorsey's band, he moved to Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey, which is in Bergen County, a more fashionable suburb of New York City, and started telling people that he was a Hasbrook Heights native, and eliminated Hoboken from his biography entirely. But he had that relationship. He hardly ever went to Hoboken. He did visit in 1984 with Ronald Reagan, when Reagan wanted to make a campaign stop in Hoboken, and he asked Sinatra to join him, and Sinatra did so, but he was there barely for an hour and then departed for New York City right away and didn't stay for the entire campaign stop. But, he told Pete Hamill, a favorite writer of his, that he tried to escape, this is in paraphrasing Sinatra, that he tried to escape the Hoboken connection and thought that he had left it forever, but later found out that Hoboken was probably part of his life for all of his life.
It's interesting with Sinatra, the man, the family man, and we brought it up earlier about his son being kidnapped, married to Nancy, and then his tryst with Ava Gardner, and on and on and on with that. But when it came down to a family struggle like the kidnapping of his son, was Frank Sinatra a family man when he wanted to be?
Well, of course, there's no question that he loved his family. I think he always loved his first wife, Nancy, but didn't want to stay married to her. She was, part of the New Jersey heritage that he wanted to escape. He was, at the time he sort of dropped her and started taking up with various Hollywood starlets even before Ava Gardner. She was just old school, and he was the new Hollywood star and wanted someone with more glamour. In any event, he kept in touch with them, mostly was on favorable terms with Nancy. She's still alive, by the way. She's still alive. I think she's 98 years old.
Really?
And I'm not sure what her health condition is, but she's still alive, and I'm sure is out in California near her daughter Nancy Sinatra, the daughter Nancy, living out in that area. Frank had three children: Nancy Jr., who was born in 1940. She's 75 now. Frank Jr., who was born in 1944. I think he will turn 71, soon. And then a second daughter, Christina, who was born in 1948. All three of them, you know, are part of the Sinatra legacy. They very jealously guard his legend and his legacy. I tried to communicate with them several times to interview them, but they simply ignore most interview requests.
It's Richard Booties here, and we're talking about Frank Sinatra, The Legend at 100. Click on the link in the show notes to learn more about the book and how you can purchase it. Now, Frank Sinatra, the singer, obviously, Frank Sinatra spent some time in the 50s television. I remember the Welcome Home Elvis special for Timex, but he wasn't really that big in television, or am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. It's a good observation. He actually did not do well as a weekly television host. Most of his weekly shows, he started out with CBS and then did one for ABC, were failures. I think his CBS show was canceled after one season, and the ABC show may not have made it through one season. He just couldn't adapt his skills to the weekly show format that Milton Berle so famously conquered, that Ed Sullivan did, that variety show format. It didn't take to Sinatra's character. I mean, he sang beautifully on these shows, but it just wasn't his milieu. He couldn't do it. He could appear as a guest on other people's shows, one-time shots as guests, or that Elvis special that you mentioned, and they would be tremendously received. But for the most part, critics panned his other appearances on television shows. His two areas in which he excelled, of course, were singing records and acting.
Again, now we go into acting, and one of my favorite Sinatra movies, Von Ryan's Express, and From Here to Eternity, all of them really, what was his favorite? You know, the Song and Dance Man with Gene Kelly, to the War Pitcher, to, you name it. I can't think of the one where they actually banned it for a while. Anyway, you'll
come. That was the Manchurian Candidate.
Candidate.
Presidential Assassin, yeah.
What about Sinatra, the actor?
Sinatra, the actor, thought he won the Academy Award for the wrong film.
Yeah.
Now, he did win it, and he was very pleased to win Best Supporting Actor Oscar for From Here to Eternity. That was a 1953 film, and he won it in a superb cast involving Montgomery Clift, Burt Lancaster, Deborah Carr, and Sinatra played Private Angelo Maggio, an Italian GI in pre-World War II Hawaii at Schofield Barracks, and he did a superb job. Sinatra coveted that part more than anything else, and I lay out the campaign that he and Ava Gardner engaged in order to win that role for him, but it was really quite interesting. We could spend the whole show talking about that. But in any event, 2 years later, Sinatra starred in The Man with the Golden Arm, about a drug addict, card dealer, wannabe musician by the name of Frankie Machine. Sinatra played that role for director Otto Preminger, and was nominated for the Academy Award that year, and really felt that he had given his best performance. I mean, his cold turkey withdrawal scenes in that film are marvelous to look at now, to see the acting that went into it. And I think he did it in one take, too, for Preminger. But in any event, he thought he should have won the Oscar for that role, and was disappointed that he didn't.
You know, when Sinatra, again, and you mentioned Ava Gardner, the actor, the ladies' man, quite a list of accomplishments, if you can use that, but did Frank Sinatra ever have one true love?
Well, I guess most people would agree that Ava Gardner was his one true love. He spent most of his life pursuing her, and I guess, lamenting the fact that he couldn't keep her. She was as volatile in temperament as he was. They would fight constantly and then make up most gloriously afterward. He was married to her, but it didn't last 2 years before they were separated, and I think a few years later she actually divorced him by going to Mexico and getting a Mexican divorce. But even after they separated and after they divorced, Frank remained devoted to her. He would get together with her once in a while when their paths crossed. He would support her financially when she went broke, and really was supportive of her right up until her death.
If you love Frank Sinatra like I do, you'll enjoy the book. It will be coming out soon, The Sinatra Legend at 100, by my author, Richard Mutti, who's my guest. And let's switch gears a little bit here now and talk about the Rat Pack. You mentioned Peter Lawford earlier, but, of course, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr. And one of the things that you hear about Sinatra, not a lot, but I have heard about before, is that he was anti-racial. He was really hard on those who were blackballing the Negroes at the time, the Sammy Davis Juniors, and he welcomed that, and he was a very anti-racist. Let's talk a little bit about that.
He was a crusader for civil rights, a crusader for tolerance, and racial tolerance and religious tolerance all his life. In 1945, he won a special Oscar for his film short, The House We Live In, in which he spoke out in favor of racial and religious tolerance to a group of young men. I'm not sure what the source of that feeling of protectiveness for those of different races and those of different religions. It may have been in Sinatra's self-image as an underdog. He feels he brought himself up from the mean streets of Hoboken, so to speak, and became a great star, and he was a champion of the underdog. That was his self-image. But there was another side to that coin, Dana, in that Sinatra, while being a champion of racial and religious tolerance, also used racial and ethnic epithets against individuals who crossed him.
Yeah.
If he got angry and flew off the handle, which he did frequently, he wasn't above using some sort of racial or ethnic epithet against the individual who had crossed him. Sammy Davis Jr., who was like a little brother to Sinatra. Sinatra loved him sincerely and deeply as a fellow human being. But in one radio interview, Sammy Davis Jr. said something mildly critical of Sinatra, and Sinatra lambasted him to Peter Lawford and other friends verbally and cut Sammy Davis Jr. out of his life for a couple of months until Davis abjectly apologized in public, and then Sinatra relented and allowed him to come back into the Rat Pack, so to speak. But there was that dual nature of him that is hard to understand, but I lay out some of the theory behind it and my own personal theory behind it in the book.
You know, a quick temper, we hear, and not a fan of reporters, those that wrote stories about him. But yet he did few interviews. I can remember seeing him on the Tonight Show a few times with Carson and others, but that persona of being Frank, the chairman of the board, them talking about when they would do their Rat Pack performances about the gangster sleeping upstairs, did he use that to his advantage? Was it shtick? Was it real? Did he really have that much power?
It was real, but they used it also as shtick in their nightclub acts. The Rat Pack did, and Sinatra did in his interviews and in his public persona. He used it, but that was the life he lived. He was, I think it was Jerry Lewis who called him a mafia wannabe. No, it was Shirley MacLaine who called him a mafia wannabe because He felt that he loved that lifestyle, the alpha male lifestyle, the concept of keeping loyalty above all else and staying silent against adversity. He loved that lifestyle. It was Eddie Fisher who said that Sinatra once told him that he would rather be a mafia don than president of the United States. That was you know, through Eddie Fisher that quote came out. But in any event, Sinatra lived the lifestyle privately and publicly.
When you we talk so much about Sammy Davis Jr., the Rat Pack and stuff, but he also had a special relationship with Dean Martin, and some of what you read and hear is that Dean Martin pulled him out of a few scrapes too. Let's talk about their relationship.
They were like brothers, Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra. Their families were close. Dean's children and Frank's children almost looked upon themselves as cousins. They were that close. Frank and Dean performed together on many occasions, not just as members of the Rat Pack, but they would go out and perform in concerts together. Dean sort of lost heart after his son, Dino, died in a Air National Guard plane crash. His son, Dino, was an Air National Guard pilot and was killed in a plane crash. And Dean sort of went downhill after that, mentally and physically. He just lost it, and I can understand losing a child in the prime of that child's life is really something that's hard for any parent to endure. But Sinatra, you know, tried to get him to snap out of it. He took him on tour. That didn't work out. Dean just couldn't work anymore, and finally Sinatra got Liza Minnelli to substitute for Dean Martin and continued on the tour. But they were close friends, and there's no question that they were different personalities. Dean was more laid back, more into golf, not into late night rollicking as Sinatra was, but they got along famously.
Let's talk a little bit about it. I happened to be tuning around on the radio this morning, and I heard a re-release of an Elvis song. They've put his vocals with a Philharmonic orchestra. So when you have the Elvises and the Sinatras and these deceased artists that are still in making as much money, if not more, than when they were alive, what about that? What about that persona and that legacy as it goes, well, you know, now he's 100?
Sure. I mean, the Sinatra legacy is still alive. You know, there's a Sirius XM radio, satellite radio show or station, really, Seriously Sinatra, that's on all the time. Nancy Sinatra is on playing her father's records. The station really specializes in Sinatra records. There's still books being written about him. Mine is one of, I think, 5 or 6 books that are coming out about Sinatra or have come out in this centennial year. There must be dozens of others that were written in the years after his death in 1998. When he died in 98, by the way, I think he left an estate of $200 million, which was largely comprised of his music legacy, all of his recordings that he owned, and you know, he left all of that musicology to his children.
It's we're running out of time, and I want to thank Richard for coming on the program. We've got about 5 minutes. Let's talk about Sinatra. You know, I remember the retirement concert, and then he came back and he did a little work, like you say, with the tried to bring the Rat Pack back a little bit. But what about the last few years? What was that like for Frank Sinatra?
Well, for any Sinatra fan, it was painful
to
see him performing in those last few years. I think he was actually on stage right up through 1984 when he was I think in his late 70s, 78 maybe. And he started losing his memory. He went out on tour with Shirley MacLaine, and Shirley wrote a couple of books about her life, and in those books discusses being on tour with Sinatra and the fact that he couldn't always remember the words to songs he had sung thousands of times, and they, the show producers had to set up video monitors around the stage so that wherever he was walking, he would have something to read. And then later on, it became a situation in which even the video monitors couldn't help him. Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet went out with him on tour in another episode, and you know, they often had to finish songs that he started simply because he couldn't remember the words, or even in some cases where he was. He was on tour in one venue where his son Frank Sinatra Jr. was actually his band conductor, and he collapsed on stage. Later it was determined that he collapsed through dehydration, but he just carried on his career, I think probably 10 years too long. But he was the type of person that he needed that spotlight, and he wasn't willing to give it up. He wanted to go out there, and frankly, the audiences, even when he forgot the words, would sometimes finish the words to the songs themselves. They just loved him, and they weren't really that put out by the fact that he wasn't performing up to his 100% potential. They figured, most of his audiences figured, that Frank Sinatra at 60% potential was good enough for them, and they were perfectly willing to pay their money at the box office in order to see him.
You know, we all sit back and have our idols, our heroes, our mentors, people that we looked up to when we were growing up. And if you compare it to what's out there today, Richard, I think we can both agree, and maybe we're a bit biased, that faults aside, it was certainly a different era then compared to the Hollywood idol, so to speak, now. I want to give you the final word about Frank Sinatra at 100, and please let the people know how they can get the book.
Sure. As you said, on your site, there's a link to get to it. Right now, my publisher, the book is officially coming out on November 10th, but right now, up until November 10th, my publisher is offering the book at a discount at the publisher's website, and it's very easy to get to. It's called Shop, S-H-O-P, the, T-H-E, record, record.com/Sinatra book. And folks can go to that site, and they'll learn more about the book. They'll see some excerpts from the book, and they'll be able to purchase it at a discount. It's a trade paperback, a very high quality paperback, so it's not expensive, and I think it'll be well worth the purchase price, and will be a perfect Christmas gift for any Sinatra fans in their families.
My favorite Sinatra song, That's Life. How about yours?
I have a bunch of them. That's Life is certainly one of them. I like many of the ballads from In the Wee Small Hours album, No One Cares album. I'm a sentimental ballad guy, and those, you know, I could probably rattle off a dozen of them that I really love.
It's going to be a big seller for you, I hope. Santani, and I apologize for how I'm saying that, the Sinatra legend at 100, Richard Moody, always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you, Dane. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye. That's Santani. Santani? I don't know. The Sinatra legend at 100. I'm going to hold it up for the television audience to take a quick look on Access. It's a fantastic book. Hey, Richard's a fantastic author. Had him on many times talking about his books, The Charmer and others. And, you know, if you can't do it your way, then do it my way. There's a little Sinatra thing for you. Anyway, that's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it here on Scared Monkeys Radio and Access Channel 7. And we'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.